From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. We're broadcasting today from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Midterm mayhem, a strong night for women. More than 100, a record number, headed to Congress.
Donald Trump said that he was on the ballot in this election. Well, I'm really proud to say Nevada responded accordingly.
Tennesseans want a conservative U.S. senator who is going to take Tennessee values and put them to work for you in Washington, D.C.
Those new lawmakers will be accompanied by a Democratic check on President Trump. And with the midterm ink barely dry, the president turns his eye and his ire on his cabinet and the Russia probe.
I could fire everybody right now, but I don't want to stop it because politically I don't like stopping it.
Then, just hours later, his attorney general axed. Jeff Sessions jettisoned for a Trump loyalist. Constitutional questions loom about the rule of law and the future of Robert Mueller's investigation. Join us. What did you take away from these elections? Does it portend change or more of same? How strong do you think the so-called blue wave was? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from New York City is Shauna Thomas. She's D.C. Bureau Chief for Vice News. Lately, she's also been a senior producer on HBO's Vice News Tonight documentary series she's running that just wrapped up last night. Shauna Thomas, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Washington is Craig Gilbert, political reporter and Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He also writes the Wisconsin Voter blog. Craig Gilbert, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be with you, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Shauna, and Craig.
So, Craig, let's start with you for a quick moment. The president said at times, hey, I'm on the ballot. Vote as if this is about me. How much were these elections about the president of the United States?
Well, he played a huge role, I think. It was funny. At the end of the campaign, both sides were kind of avoiding talking about him in their advertising, except in very partisan areas. But he loomed large. I think, if you look at a state like Wisconsin, his approval rating among voters who went to the polls Tuesday was just under 50%, which wasn't a bad number for him. But if you look at how those people voted, not only how they voted, but also there was a real correlation between where Trump was weak and strong when he ran for president and where Republicans, at least in Wisconsin, were weak and strong in the elections on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip. Just on Wednesday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who was somebody who was embraced by the president, initially one of his seemingly early strong rivals, 2016 race. But, Walker really faltered. He had been such a force here in the state of Wisconsin for so long. And he conceded the race to Democrat Tony Evers, been the state superintendent of schools. Evers told voters that he wants to see unity in the state moving forward.
We have won last night, but the race is now over, and now it is time for us to come together. I just, as a result of that, in addition to that, I just read a gracious call from Governor Walker, who just a little bit ago, he said that he conceded the race, and was very gracious and talked about the transition and how his staff will be available for our staff to create the new government, and it was a very, very good conversation.
Craig Gilbert, a lot of real estate to cover this hour, a lot in the midterms to do, but let's do a light touch here. What does it mean for Scott Walker to go down to defeat when he was seeking his third term?
Well, I think it happened for reasons particular to Scott Walker. It also Trump was a contributing factor, but 8 years, failed presidential campaign, very divisive and polarizing governor, a very evenly divided state, facing political headwinds in this election. You know, one of the twists in the Trump-Walker dynamic is that Scott Walker had a really strong suburban base in Wisconsin, and did very well and has done very well in these Republican suburbs outside Milwaukee. But one of the key factors in the election Tuesday was his margins in those base suburban counties diminished in this election compared to 2014. And again, the same counties where Donald Trump underperformed in 2016. So the sort of the Trump suburban problem kind of rubbed off on Scott Walker in this election. The Trump vote in the rural areas held up for him. But this massive outpouring in Democratic cities like the one you're in, which just remarkable numbers, combined with softness in the suburbs, was his undoing. And now with his defeat, you know, the famous big three Wisconsin Republicans, you know, three national figures, Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, and Reince Priebus, the former party chair and chief of staff, are now kind of exited from the political stage 2 years into the Trump presidency.
Badgers in exile. Shauna Thomas, you've been following races all over the country. One of them you followed in particular involved a Katie Hill, a 31-year-old Democrat, a first-time candidate. She just won California's 25th congressional district. It was one, as I understand it, north of L.A., one that leans Republican. You helped to capture her response on what happened as she realized that she was winning the election, her moment of victory Tuesday night. You captured it in part for Vice News for HBO, and it was also captured in part by comments she made to KCBS TV in Los Angeles.
Hey, guys. Steve Knight just called to concede.
Wow. So wait, so he called?
Yeah, you
want
to listen to the voicemail?
Yeah.
Hello, Katie. This is Steve Knight. I want to call and congratulate you. If there's anything I can do, reach out to us, okay?
I want to play whatever role I can, and I hope that there are, and I believe that there are enough new members coming from these purple districts who are going to have the same mandate.
Shauna Thomas, as you look at the story of Katie Hill, which you've documented, and as you think about other races, were the Democrats, the 30-plus swings in Democratic seats, were they influenced more by moderate Democrats appealing to purple voters? Were they more progressives who are articulating a clearer break with the president and politics as it's always been done?
I mean, I really think that one of the things this election shows is that people campaigned how their districts wanted them to campaign. And I think one of the things that Nancy Pelosi did was she stayed out of a lot of races. And there wasn't like a really unifying big Democratic message, right? And what we saw with Katie Hill is it's not that she didn't embrace progressivism. She definitely fundraised with Nancy Pelosi. But Nancy Pelosi was never in her district. She knew that one, her district has it did lean Republican. It does lean Republican. But it was also a district that voted for Steve Knight, the Republican incumbent in 2016, but also voted for Hillary Clinton by multiple points in 2016. So there was room to maneuver. Her campaign specifically did something that I think not a lot of campaigns necessarily embrace, which is from the very beginning, Ms. Hill was determined to try to get low propensity voters out. She was determined to get young people out. She was determined to get some African American groups, some Hispanics out to vote for her. And the conventional wisdom in politics is, especially in a midterm, go for the people you know always vote. And I'm not saying Katie Hill's campaign didn't do that, but they also put in a lot of effort, time, and money into trying to get people who don't usually vote. The thing is, she only won by about 4,000 votes. It's not a huge margin, but she thinks that doing that effort from the very beginning to try to get low-propensity voters out is part of what got her the win.
Jack Beatty, obviously in Texas— there was a big marquee race in which the Republicans prevailed. It looked as though Ted Cruz was going to sail to victory, and then suddenly it looked very close indeed, a fairly close margin. He held on to his Ted Cruz held on to his seat, and he spoke to voters at a victory rally in Houston after the election night.
We saw an assault that was unprecedented. We saw a $100 million race with Hollywood coming in against the state, with the national media coming in against the state. But all the money in the world was no match for the good people of Texas and the hardworking men and women across our state.
Beto O'Rourke didn't win that Senate seat, but people paid close attention to him, and they paid close attention to how he wrapped up his campaign. Here's a few remarks from his concession speech Tuesday night in El Paso, talking about what he hopes were the lasting effects of his campaign.
I love you more than words can express, and that love will persist every single day going forward, making sure that whatever we have created, whatever we have changed, and all of us will decide what that means and how far it goes, that it leads something far greater than what we have today, and that all of us, every single one of us, continue to believe and make possible the greatness of the United States of America.
Jack Beatty, is there a lasting legacy for the O'Rourke campaign?
Well, I think right there we heard that he was adumbrating a presidential run. He said, you know, we have more work to do. And he spoke of the United States of America, not just Texas. You know, people, Todd Domke, who's an excellent political analyst for WBUR, made this comparison. He pointed out that Abraham Lincoln had had one term in the House, lost, and then years later, in 1858, ran for the Senate in Illinois, lost, but made a terrific impression on Northern voters. And 2 years later, this dark horse went with only one term in Congress, won the presidency. And, of course, he's saying, is this analogous? Beto O'Rourke loses. 2 years later, there's a presidential election. Well, we don't know. What we do know is that he made a tremendous impression, partly because of what was unique about him in such a divisive year. He actually tried to persuade voters, people who didn't agree with him, in that famous and justly celebrated extemporaneous defense of players taking the knee. He's talking, in defending that, he's talking to a military person, military veteran, who said, I don't like this. I want to see patriotism. He's trying to persuade that gentleman. That's almost unheard of in politics today. That's called trying to create a new kind of coalition and a new kind of politics. We'll have to see.
Politics of hope, a mantle of Lincoln-esque proportions, perhaps a lot to put on a just defeated Senate candidate, but I hear the historical allusion. You've just heard Jack Beatty. We also have Shauna Thomas, Craig Gilbert with us. We want you to stick around. We're talking about this week's biggest news stories, and they were big. You can join our conversation. What do you make of President Trump's move to force out Attorney General Jeff Sessions? What are the implications? What do you think about the future of the Russia investigation? Me, I'm David Folkenflik. It's Folkenflik Fridays here on Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're broadcasting today from Buck Studio here at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, and we're recapping an extraordinary week in the news. You can join our conversation. What's next for Robert Mueller's Russia probe now that the midterms are behind us? How comfortable are you with a Justice Department led by an attorney general who's defended the president from probe on cable news? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Shauna Thomas, D.C. Bureau Chief for Vice News, and On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. We do want to take some of your calls, and they're flooding in. We've got Steve calling from Orono, Maine. What do you make of the elections?
So what I make of the election as an older person is the older commentators, the older print media folks, the older TV folks, the older politicians want to see this as, oh, you know, this has happened before and everything. I see it as a tsunami of culture change. And standing in line on the biggest campus of Maine, the University of Maine, Orono, listening to people 18 to maybe 30, they weren't angry. They were there because now they understand how the system works. They're going to vote. They were empowered by Alexandria, by O'Rourke, by Presley, and they see as they can take back what they see growing up was their America, and they're going to change it. And a lot of people want to discount it, and they don't want to believe it. But you know what? I remember sitting in this country, and when, you know, the Vietnam War and the protests of, you know, women's rights and all that, the same, what we used to call the man, used to say that, you know, oh, these kids are crazy, they're wacko, they're on, you know, on that marijuana, you know, and
but now you see they're coming in to vote.
They're coming in to vote. They understand that you can do anything. If you do anything, you got to vote.
And terrific. Steve, thank you so much for that. We've also got a call from Enid, Oklahoma. Teresa, go ahead.
Hi, I'm an independent, and I just want to say I don't think either party represents my views. I am more of an FDR type of liberal, I guess if you want to call it that. I think that we have had a false narrative of macroeconomic abilities at the national level, that both parties have fostered austerity. And in the last 40 years, you know, that means we've fostered poverty, ignorance, illness, a crumbling infrastructure, and there's no reason for it. FDR and Eisenhower built the middle class and decades of prosperity with deficit spending because taxes don't fund federal spending.
And okay, well, Teresa, thank you for that. We're hearing from an independent voice, but one that would currently be seen on the left. We're hearing from different voices from Capitol Hill, including Republicans, who are saying that a different voice was heard during these elections. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell commented on what is being dubbed the Kavanaugh effect, that is the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. McConnell was speaking in a press conference on Wednesday morning, noted that Joe Manchin, what he called the one Democrat in a red state who survived, voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh.
I think the Republican sort of core voters in the states that were critical to us were highly offended by the questioning of the presumption of innocence and the tactics. And I think it was like an adrenaline shot.
Shauna Thomas of Vice News, did you see any consistency to the way in which the Kavanaugh nomination played out across the country?
I think one of the things that we saw is that did energize voters. It energized voters on both sides. It was sort of at the right point where things started to consolidate and people started to pay attention, and that made them pay attention more to the election. I think not to go back to Katie Hill in California's 25th district, but I'm going to go back to Katie Hill in California's
sure.
25th district. They actually saw a tightening of their internal polls after the Judge Kavanaugh hearings. They saw that more Republicans were paying attention after that. They saw that their poll numbers went down. That wasn't the only reason her poll numbers went down at that point, but it did clearly have an effect. And in their internal polls, they saw that more than 50% of the people in that district were pro Kavanaugh being seated on the Supreme Court. So it definitely focused people on the election a lot more. But I also want to go back to something that your first caller said just about what he saw in line. And I think it's worth noting that there were a lot of firsts in this election. The Democratic caucus in the House will be 60% women. The first two Muslim women were elected to Congress. The first openly gay man was elected to be governor of Colorado, Congressman Jared Polis, or current Congressman Jared Polis. So I think some of the energy we saw was also people wanting to support people who looked like them, who represent America a little bit more. And I don't think that can be diminished.
It's worth noting, of course, thinking about Justice Kavanaugh, that, of course, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg landed in the hospital. She, I believe, cracked or broke three ribs in a fall in her office. She's said to be up and working, but obviously that'll be something closely watched as the president appears to have consolidated his control on the Senate, even as he's lost things in the House of Representatives. I wanted to go also to Georgia, which, of course, was one of the states like Florida that was closely watched in recent weeks. As midterm votes trickled in Tuesday night, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Stacey Abrams, refused to concede to her opponent, Brian Kemp, who is also the Republican Secretary of State until just today.
Across our state, folks are opening up the dreams of voters in absentee ballots, and we believe our chance for a stronger Georgia is just within reach. But we cannot seize it until all voices are heard. And I promise you tonight, we're going to make sure that every vote is counted.
We've seen some statements this morning and last night from the president. President Trump tweeted last night, law enforcement looking into another big corruption scandal having to do with election fraud in Broward and Palm Beach. Florida voted for Rick Scott. This morning, the president, speaking to reporters out the White House, said Broward County has a horrible history with elections. Craig Gilbert, you know, my colleague Steve Inske pointed out this morning online that President Clinton, even during the 2000 recount in Florida, tried to soothe the waters rather than inflame passions, saying, you know, let this play out. You know, it will work. What is the role of voting itself here playing in these states? How much do people have faith in how this will play out?
Well, I think when you have, you know, two political parties so far apart yet so kind of evenly competing, that it's just – it raises the stakes of these elections, but it also ensures we're going to have a lot of really, really, really close elections that are going to be litigated under the most bitter circumstances. And I don't – you know, our system doesn't always hold up to that very well. And I think, you know, the voters are in a way creating this environment because, you know, asked to choose between two parties very far apart, they can't make up their minds. And when they do, and you almost had the situation in Wisconsin on Tuesday where you had an incredibly close race for governor that was only decided when a lot of absentee ballots in the city of Milwaukee were counted very late in the process, which again is the kind of thing that can sort of raise suspicions on the losing side about an outcome. And we've seen this in so many close elections around the country in the past.
You know, obviously the midterms mark a moment. The president basically suggested if the Democrats come after him, he might go after them and that he would take on a warlike posture. He is also changing the subject in some ways. The White House issuing a rule that would make it exceptionally difficult for people who are migrants coming to this country and who get in illegally to seek asylum afterward. Jack Beatty, what do you make of his making this move? How serious a venture is it?
Well, we'll have to see. It'll be challenged. The ACLU has already said this is not this doesn't comport with U.S. law, which says that anybody who steps on our shores and appeals for asylum can be heard. The president is saying no, they have to go to ports of entry, and of course that'll produce these sort of scenes, rending scenes in many cases, of bridges full of distraught people, children crying, waiting to be heard, and lines backing up, and on the Mexican side, gangsters, you know, taking advantage of people. It'll be a frightful scene set up. And you know, this goes to something very central with Trump. Before the election, the Republicans ran an internal poll that showed that almost by 2-1, people saw their tax cut as Pluto populism. You know, $978 a year for the average taxpayer, $500 million apiece a year for the Koch brothers. They saw that clearly. And they knew they couldn't run on that. So Trump ran on, quote, immigration, on the other, on all this stuff. And the Yale historian, Timothy Snyder, calls this appeal sado-populism. That is to say, people understand the government isn't doing anything for them. Trump isn't doing anything for his voters. But they can understand that their own pain is a sign of, you know, greater pain inflicted on others, that there's this element in Trumpism of we're going to punish these people. And he's saying to his voters, I may not be doing anything for you, but I'm satisfying that sense of yours that somebody else is getting it. And I think I think we see it right here. He's going right back to the immigration. He's going right back to scenes mayhem, really, and or at least moral mayhem on these bridges.
I want to move now to a story that is of real consequence as well, and an enduring one, and that's the question of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He was forced out, as he made clear in his resignation letter. He said that he was doing it at the president's request. And he's being replaced, at least in an acting basis, by Matt Whitaker, the chief of staff for the Justice Department. Shauna Taunis, what do you make of this? What do you take from the president's decision to act so swiftly on this?
Well, I think it definitely changes the narrative. I mean, he did this the day after the election. And you know, he did have something to be proud of with the election when it comes to the Senate, the Republicans being able to keep the Senate, flip some seats. But he put the focus back on himself. He put the focus back on Jeff Sessions, and he put the focus back on the Russia investigation. What it weirdly might do is actually kind of be a bipartisan thing, especially in the Senate. We expect Democratic Senator Chris Coons and Republican Senator Jeff Flake to try to push a bill that they had already introduced to protect the Mueller investigation. And it sets him up in some ways for 2020. And by him, I mean the president. It sets him up for 2020. He now can say, hey, look, I am the guy who does what I think. I'm the one in control. Attorney General Jeff Sessions wasn't doing what I wanted him to do when it came to the Russia investigation. So I'm going to try to put someone in place who will do that. And
I mean, Shauna,
he
repeatedly humiliated the Attorney General, and he humiliated him on particularly the Mueller matters, among other things, right?
He did. And the weird thing about that in some ways is Jeff Sessions was one of his, from a conservative point of view, one of his most effective cabinet members. I mean, I don't necessarily know what Ben Carson is doing over at HUD. I haven't seen him. What I do know is that Jeff Sessions was carrying out a very, very hardline immigration position. He was carrying out a very hardline position on other criminal activities in this country. He was, and because he was a senator, because he's been in the government for so long, he understood how government worked. He knew what he could do. He knew the confines of the law. He knew what that position could be. He was actually doing what President Trump espoused on the campaign trail, and he ended up on the outs because he was also following the law when it came to the Mueller investigation. It's fascinating that the president ousted the guy who is carrying out his legacy in some ways, but the Mueller investigation is an obsession for the president, understandably so. And that meant Jeff Sessions was not long for this world, and people kind of knew that after the election this might happen.
You know, usually presidents in such circumstances tend to be circumspect. I think this president tends to be whatever the opposite of that is, blatant. Let's hear from the new acting attorney general. We have a clip here from July 2017. He was appearing on CNN. Whitaker, a former U.S. attorney and strong supporter in many ways of the president, but talking about what might happen to Robert Mueller's Russia investigation if the president were to fire the attorney general.
I could see a scenario where Jeff Sessions is replaced with a recess appointment, and that attorney general doesn't fire Bob Mueller, but he just reduces his budget so low that his investigation grinds to almost a halt.
So you hear there a scenario which might undermine the special prosecutor offered by the man who's now gets to oversee Bob Mueller. He's not recused from this. We have a call from Chris. He's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Chris, I understand you have some thoughts on this.
Yes, I think that guy, he doesn't know what he's saying, reducing the budget to a crawl. That's obstruction of justice. He's going to go to jail. I know Trump is not going to go to jail, but Trump needs to be in jail because a lot of times, a lot of these crimes that these people get away with, the little guy, they want to put him in jail for a long time. But Trump and his cronies and those people up there doing the same crimes or worse when it comes to money laundering,
Chris,
and they're not in
Chris,
jail.
I appreciate that. It's strong words. On the other hand, strong accusations circling around the president. Certainly, we shouldn't let the get too far ahead of the indictments, much less any convictions of everyone, especially our chief executive. That said, Craig Gilbert, what are the stakes here? If Whitaker were to assert control over this probe, how could it alter what Robert Mueller's up to?
Well, you know, a couple of things. The politics of this are pretty murky, I think, for both sides. One interesting finding in the exit poll I noticed. And again, this is in a state, Wisconsin, where Democrats had a very successful election. But more voters thought that the Mueller investigation was politically motivated. The investigation of Russian influence in the election was politically motivated than justified. So, you know, it's a tangled issue politically. And you know, the other big consequence of the election was that we're moving farther away from what may have been a faint possibility of bipartisan pushback or bipartisan action on this because, some of the Republicans who might have been most likely to push back on the president are gone, either in many cases retiring, in some cases losing. And of course, now the Democrats have a perch of power in the House.
Back in swing, providing a check on that. You've been hearing there from Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He'll stay with us. Shauna Thomas of Vice News, stick around. Of course, our own Jack Beatty as well. We'd like you to stick with us. We're talking about the week's news and what a week it has been, what a week it will be. Among other things, the president reengages his rhetorical clash with the press. We'll be talking about a lot more. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. The president this morning has been weighing in about his appointment of Matt Whitaker as the acting attorney general. He's been responding to reports that, among other things, that Whitaker was the White House's eyes and ears inside the Department of Justice, and that he had the president's trump. The president this morning said Whitaker is a respected man. He also responded to an op-ed that was co-written by George Conway, a Republican lawyer who happens to be married to the president's senior counsel, Kellyanne Conway. The president said George Conway just wants publicity. Trump also said the Russia investigation is a hoax, so not hiding his light under a bushel. And he says, well, Matt Whitaker, I don't know Matt Whitaker. Matt Whitaker worked for Jeff Sessions. He was always extremely highly thought of, and he still is, but I don't know Matt Whitaker. He worked for Attorney General Sessions. So I think we get a message there. We also want to get a message from Dahlia. She's calling from Sarasota, Florida. What's on your mind, Dahlia?
Hello. I would like to point out a couple things, starting with the Russia investigation. We all know that Russians will spy on a U.S. hockey team. That is their M.O. I don't want to waste more time and money investigating all this so much, because the truth is we can do other stuff with our time and money. Really, knock it off. We need to work on infrastructure. We need to get monorails in Florida and have Ford build the parts and revive Detroit at the same time, instead of trying to compete with the Asian markets, the Swedish and the German cars. Okay, Jeff Sessions, my opinion of him, he needed to go. He was trying to make more prisoners in this country. And that's another thing that's costing us a lot, too many prisoners. I couldn't stand Jeff Sessions. I was with the president, you know, he went, whoops, I made a mistake, and I was with him way back when he said, you know, Jeff isn't the best. And I agree.
Dahlia, can I ask you a question? Just very quickly. If respected career prosecutors were to find that crimes were committed by government officials or senior figures close to the president, you know, would that criminality not disturb you even if you support the president's agenda?
Oh, yes. In that case, yes. But listen, they've had
Isn't that what the Mueller investigation is doing?
Yes, but why haven't
trying to figure it out?
Done anything? I mean, why haven't they brought out some indictments and stuff? It's time. They've had plenty.
All right. Thank you so much, Dahlia. We appreciate that insight. There have, of course, been, it's fair to say, numerous indictments on that very score. Craig Gilbert, very briefly, sketch out for us where things stand.
Well, there's more to come. I mean, I think we don't know. I think we're waiting to see how big, you know, what shoes are left to drop and how big they are. So I do think that there's, you know, a finite timeline here. And I think you know, there are political pressures. This caller kind of spoke to that, where there's sort of an urgency on the part of people to kind of get to it.
Well, and we shouldn't forget, I mean, so far you've seen indictments, convictions of people like the former national security advisor, the president's campaign chairman, campaign chairman Rick Gates, president's lawyer pleaded guilty, Michael Cohen. You know, there have been a number of folks who have been not only indicted, but in some cases gotten conviction. I want to take a moment, and more than a moment in some ways, to pause to acknowledge an atrocity committed on our own soil in the United States. 12 shot and killed in a Southern California bar Wednesday night. Jason Kaufman's 22-year-old son was one of those dozen gunned down.
His name was Cody Kaufman. My firstborn son. Only him and I know how much I love, how much I miss. Oh, God, this is so hard.
And forgive us, this is a heart-wrenching, heartbreaking moment, after which Jason Kaufman actually explicitly thanked the media for letting him share his son's story yesterday morning. Reporters also heard, I believe, KBC in Los Angeles spoke to Susan Orfanos. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. She's mother of another victim in the Thousand Oaks shootings. She said, "My son didn't come home last night. I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers. I want gun control, no more guns." Now, Jack Beatty, oftentimes the people most motivated to vote on gun control issues oppose additional gun control measures. Around the country, there were candidates and initiatives that spoke to that in different ways. Give us a feel of what happened in midterms when it comes to the question of guns.
Well, according to the Times, quote, dozens of candidates supported by gun control groups won in states, surprising states, Texas, Kansas, Colorado, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Georgia, where a woman who lost her son to gun violence was elected, took a Republican seat, was elected to Congress. Voters in Washington State, which, remember, is a rural state once you get outside of Seattle, passed some of the strictest gun control measures in the country. Exit polls taken nationally showed 60% of voters want tougher gun laws as opposed to 30%. So this was not a good year for the NRA. The NRA endorsement was for some Republican candidates a scarlet letter. On the other hand, in this state, New Hampshire, our governor, Chris Sununu, was easily enough elected, and he stood in a debate, and someone said to him, "Well, can someone walk into a public school carrying a gun that isn't, it's not in law enforcement?" He said, "Yeah, that's the Second Amendment." And I thought, live free or die. Here we are. I mean, there's the grip of the NRA on a politician. It still happens. It's still out there. But this was not a good year for the NRA.
Shona Thomas, you know, we had a listener write into us and say, you know, there are a lot of gun laws on the books, and new ones were added after the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Are these laws not being enforced? Is there not a will there, or are they not written in ways that are intended to be effective?
I mean, that is a difficult question. I'm not going to say they're not being enforced. I think this is one of those issues where we have to talk about access to guns and whether the access to guns should be more limited in this country, depending on what kind of guns we're talking about. But it is hard to protect people. It is hard to protect people against people who maybe, have mental issues. But what we know is that in the case of the election with Gabby Gifford's group, with Michael Bloomberg, the amount of money they put into some of these campaigns, as Jack was saying, was tremendous. And that was in effect to try to get people in office who would put limits on what kind of guns you can buy. I also think one of the heartbreaking things about what happened in California is that there was someone in that bar who was also attending the concert in Las Vegas. We live in a country right now where someone can be involved in two mass shootings in the span of, less than a couple of years. And it will be interesting to see in 2020 how the NRA tries to combat against people like Bloomberg, people like former Representative Gabby Giffords in trying to put people on the ballot who are ardent Second Amendment supporters. I mean, we're going to continue to see this play out.
So let's move from actual and horrific attack to the rhetorical strife that we see between the President of the United States and the press corps. A couple really recent instances, particularly at that testy news conference at the White House on Wednesday. There was a particular one I have in mind to start with. President Trump got into this heated exchange with CNN's Jim Acosta.
Mr. President, if I may ask
Peter,
one other
ahead.
Question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's
Mr.
enough.
Mr. President,
I was
going to ask one of the other folks.
That's
had,
enough.
Pardon me, ma'am.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other
Peter,
question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
Craig Gilbert, a Washington bureau chief and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, you've attended press conferences like these, but maybe not just like these until this presidency. The president called a chief White House correspondent for CNN a rude, terrible person. Remind us what happened in that scene and what you make of it.
Well, I mean, there's a history there, obviously. There's the broader history of his relationship with the media, and then there's a history with his exchanges with that reporter's network and that particular reporter. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to voters over the past year, and often those conversations turn to the media. And obviously, people are incredibly polarized over the media. I mean, one thing I'll say is that even in this environment where people are polarized over the media and where there's an adversarial relationship between the media and the president, I never felt hostility talking to even people that were highly critical of the media. But it's such a trap, I think, for the media. I mean, there's no good sort of ending for this because it divides people. It creates, an adversarial relationship, which is kind of a very uncomfortable place to be, I think, for most media institutions. And people have to go ahead and do their jobs. But in terms of the way it looks to the electorate at large, it divides people. And so it creates a situation where one side of the political divide, has faith and credibility in traditional media and the other side doesn't.
Jack Beatty, I'm going to broaden this out in a second, but for the moment, I want to focus on Acosta. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders sent out a video to indicate that she felt that in the sort of tussle over the microphone you heard in that clip, at one point Jim Acosta says, excuse me, ma'am, he's basically trying to keep the microphone that the White House intern is trying to grab out of his hands, that she released a video that seems to show he's really kind of pushing her away with a strong forearm like a hockey player. That video seems very much to have been doctored, and in fact, it's almost identical to a video put out by an editor for InfoWars, which is Alex Jones' outfit. How serious is it that the White House press secretary seems to be claiming that Acosta did a kind of assault there, and also the source on which she seemed to be relying to make that claim?
It's very serious. It's arrant propaganda. We reach for our Orwell. Quote, the party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. That's what the Trump administration has been doing. That's what this whole attack on fake news is about. Don't listen to the news. Don't attend to reality. Don't look at that. Listen to me. And in almost a cult-like fashion, millions of voters respond to that. What Craig talks about, this mistrust of the media, has just kind of spilled over into this, unwillingness to accept even basic facts. And we're back to Orwell with reject the evidence of your senses because I tell you to.
We have a call from Boston, Maryland. William, I understand you have some thoughts on this very question.
Massachusetts. But yes, I would love Trump's microscopic, macroscopic behaviors with the press corps seem to be just like everything else that he does with our country. And I would love to see the press corps just kind of join together and maybe boycott him one time or something and send a message with their power. I know that would be a challenging and terrifically difficult thing to do, but I think it would really send a true message and not a fake one. Thanks very much. I'll take your comment off the air.
Thanks so much, Craig. Apparently Boston, Maryland, fake news, Boston, Massachusetts. Shauna Thomas, I briefly want to address that to you. John Stewart said, press should stop taking the bait. Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post wrote the press should sue the president for the White House revoking the hard press pass of Jim Acosta and stand together legally against him.
Well, I mean, behind the scenes, the White House press corps, the multiple news networks and news organizations in D.C. are standing behind CNN and are standing behind Jim Acosta and having meetings with the White House and trying to get that reconciled. I think the issue that your caller brought up from Boston, Massachusetts, it is very difficult to boycott the president of the United States. And, you know, I have this argument with my mother all the time, who likes to inform me from her position in Texas in in my childhood home, how she feels about everything in Washington, D.C. But we can't, as journalists, we can't ignore the guy who is one of the most powerful people in the world.
Right.
And I understand why your caller feels that way. And I understand that that the president seems to be diminishing what I do for a living, but we still have to cover him. We still have to tell people what this White House is doing and what he is doing. Now, does that mean we have to carry every single speech the president does live on cable news?
Different.
No,
question.
And each network gets to make their own decisions about that. But there's no boycotting the guy who has his, you know, finger on the nuclear button. There's no boycotting the guy that represents us in the rest of the world. And there's no boycotting the guy who sits in the Oval Office.
So I want to turn very briefly to another clash you had with a reporter that day during a press conference at the White House. During that same press conference, PBS NewsHour White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor prompted a pointed response from the president when she asked this question.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that the president. That's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? I mean, why do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question.
Deeply misleading. I referenced those poll numbers, but the president went on to say that Alcindor's question was so insulting to him, a terrible thing that she said. In about the 25 seconds we have left, Shauna Thomas of Vice News, the president has insulted three other female reporters of color this week. Is there something singular about the way he responds to journalists of color?
I can't be in the president's head, but it is definitely noticed by not only journalists of color, but also journalists who are white, everybody else, that he seems to dismiss them. April Ryan, from the very beginning of this presidency, was not treated well by this president. Abby Phillip, who is now of CNN, was dismissed by this president this week. And, it is hard not to think that there is a pattern there.
Aisha Roscoe of NPR as well added that list this week as well. You've just been hearing the voice of Shauna Thomas, D.C. Bureau Chief of Vice News. Really glad to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've also been joined by Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
Special thanks to the team here at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison this week for their help in making this broadcast possible, including Tom Blaine, Bradley Bryan, Audrey Ralph, and Radio Operations. Our executive producers, Karen Schiffman, me, I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for listening to Folkenflik Fridays. This show is On Point.